But then perhaps you're here to tell me I have no choice in the matter. The choice for Carhide is yours, sir. And if I send you packing, too, why, I'll go. I might try again, with another generation. That hit him. He snapped, "Are you immortal?" "No, not at all, sir. But the time jumps have their uses. If I left Gethin now for the nearest world, Alul, I'd spend 17 years of planetary time getting there. Time jumping is a function of traveling nearly as fast as light. If I simply turned around and came back, my few hours spent on the ship would here amount to 34 years, and I could start all over. But the idea of time jumping, which with its false hint of immortality had fascinated everyone who listened to me, from the Horden Island fisherman on up to the Prime Minister, left him cold. He said in his shrill, harsh voice, "What's that?" pointing to the Ansible. "The Ansible communicator, sir." "A radio?" "It doesn't involve radio waves or any form of energy. The principle it works on, the constant of simultaneity, is analogous in some ways to gravity." I had forgotten again that I wasn't talking to Estravan, who had read every report on me, and who listened intently and intelligently to all my explanations, but instead to a bored king. "What it does, sir, is to produce a message at any 2 points simultaneously. Anywhere. 1 point has to be fixed, on a planet of a certain mass, but the other end is portable. That's this end. I've set the coordinates for the prime world Hine. A Nafal ship takes 67 years to go between Gethin and Hine. But if I write a message on that keyboard, it will be received on Hine at the same moment as I write it. Is there any communication you'd care to make with the Stabiles on Hine, sir?" "I don't speak Voidish," said the king with his dull, malign grin. "They'll have an aide standing ready. I alerted them, who can handle Carhidish." "What do you mean? How?" "Well, as you know, sir, I'm not the first alien to come to Gethin. I was preceded by a team of investigators who didn't announce their presence, but passed as well as they could for Gethinians, and traveled about in Carhide and Orgarin and the archipelago for a year. They left and reported to the councils of the Ecumen over 40 years ago, during your grandfather's reign. Their report was extremely favorable. And so I studied the information they'd gathered and the languages they'd recorded and came. Would you like to see the device working, sir?" "I don't like tricks, Mr. I." "It's not a trick, sir. Some of your own scientists have examined..."
"I'm not a scientist."
"You're a sovereign, my lord. Your peers on the prime world of the Ecumen wait for a word from you." He looked at me savagely. In trying to flatter and interest him, I had cornered him in a prestige trap. It was all going wrong.
"Very well. Ask your machine there, what makes a man a traitor?"
I typed out slowly on the keys, which were set to Carhidish characters, "King Argovan of Carhide asks the Stabiles on Hine what makes a man a traitor." The letters burned across the small screen and faded. Argovan watched, his restless shifting stilled for a moment. There was a pause, a long pause. Somebody 72 light-years away was no doubt feverishly punching demands on the language computer for Carhidish, if not on a philosophy storage computer. At last the bright letters burned up out of the screen, hung a while, and faded slowly away. "To King Argovan of Carhide on Gethin, greetings. I do not know what makes a man a traitor. No man considers himself a traitor. This makes it hard to find out. Respectfully, Spimoli, GF, for the Stabiles, in Sire, on Hine, 9-3-1491-45. When the tape was recorded, I pulled it out and gave it to Argovan. He dropped it on the table, walked again to the central fireplace, almost into it, and kicked the flaming logs and beat down the sparks with his hands.
"As useful an answer as I might get from any foreteller. Answers aren't enough, Mr. I, nor is your box, your machine there. Know your vehicle, your ship, a bag of tricks, and a trickster. You want me to believe you, your tales and messages. But why need I believe or listen? If there are 80,000 worlds full of monsters out there among the stars, what of it? We want nothing from them. We've chosen our way of life, and have followed it for a long time.
Carhide's on the brink of a new epoch, a great new age. We'll go our own way.
He hesitated, as if he had lost the thread of his argument, not his own argument, perhaps, in the first place. If Estravan was no longer the king's ear, somebody else was.
And if there were anything these ecumens wanted from us, they wouldn't have sent you alone. It's a joke, a hoax. Aliens would be here by the thousand.
But it doesn't take 1,000 men to open a door, my lord.
It might, to keep it open.
The ecumen will wait till you open it, sir. It will force nothing on you. I was sent alone and remain here alone in order to make it impossible for you to fear me.
Fear you, said the king, turning his shadow-scarred face, grinning, speaking loud and high. But I do fear you, envoy. I fear those who sent you. I fear liars, and I fear tricksters. And worst, I fear the bitter truth. And so I rule my country well, because only fear rules men. Nothing else works. Nothing else lasts long enough. You are what you say you are, yet you're a joke, a hoax. There's nothing in between the stars but void and terror and darkness. And you come out of that, all alone, trying to frighten me. But I am already afraid, and I am the king. Fear is king. Now take your traps and tricks and go. There's no more need saying. I have ordered that you be given the freedom of Carhide.
So I departed from the royal presence, eck, 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 all down the long red floor in the red gloom of the hall, until at last the double door shut me off from him. I had failed all around. What worried me as I left the king's house and walked through the palace grounds, however, was not my failure, but Estravan's part in it. Why had the king exiled him for advocating the ecumen's cause, which seemed to be the meaning of the proclamation, if, according to the king himself, he had been doing the opposite? When had he started advising the king to steer clear of me? And why? Why was he exiled and I let go free? Which of them had lied more? And what the devil were they lying for? Estravan, to save his skin, I decided, and the king to save his face. The explanation was neat. But had Estravan, in fact, ever lied to me? I discovered that I did not know. I was passing the corner red dwelling. The gates of the garden stood open. I glanced in at the serum trees, leaning white above the dark pool, the paths of pink brick lying deserted in the serene gray light of the afternoon. A little snow still lay in the shadow of the rocks by the pool. I thought of Estravan waiting for me there as the snow fell last night, and felt a pang of pure pity for the man whom I had seen in yesterday's parade, sweating and superb under the weight of his panoply and power, a man at the prime of his career, potent and magnificent. Gone now. Down. Done. Running for the border with his death 3 days behind him, and no man speaking to him. The death sentence is rare in Carhide. Life on Winter is hard to live, and people there generally leave death to nature, or to anger, not to law. I wondered how Estravan, with that sentence driving him, would go. Not in a car, for they were all palace property here. Would a ship or land boat give him passage, or was he afoot on the road, carrying what he could with him? Carhides go afoot, mostly. They have no beasts of burden, no flying vehicles. The weather makes slow going for a powered traffic most of the year, and they are not a people who hurry. I imagined the proud man going into exile step by step, a small, trudging figure on the long road west to the Gulf. All this went through my mind and out of it as I passed the gate of the corner red dwelling. And with it went my confused speculations concerning the acts and motives of Estravan and the king. I was done with them. I had failed. What next? I should go to Orgrun, Carhide's neighbor and rival. But once I went there, I might find it hard to return to Carhide. And I had unfinished business here. I had to keep in mind that my entire life could be and might well be used in achieving my mission for the ecumen. No hurry. No need to rush off to Orgrun before I learned more about Carhide, particularly about the fastnesses. For 2 years, I had been answering questions.
Now I would ask some, but not in Erinrong. I had finally understood that Estravan had been warning me, and though I might distrust his warning, I could not disregard it. He had been saying, however indirectly, that I should get away from the city and the court. For some reason I thought of Lord Tibby's teeth. The king had given me the freedom of the country. I would avail myself of it. As they say in ecumenical school, when action grows unprofitable, gather information. When information grows unprofitable, sleep. I was not sleepy yet. I would go east to the fastnesses and gather information from the foretellers, perhaps. Chapter 4, The 19th Day. An East Karhaidish story, as told in Goringharinghearth by Tobard Chorhawa and recorded by GA931492. Lord Beresty, Rem Ir Ippi, came to Thongaring Fastness and offered 40 barrels and half the year's yield from his orchards as the price of a foretelling, and the price was acceptable. He set his question to the weaver Audrin, and the question was, on what day shall I die? The foretellers gathered and went together into the darkness. At the end of darkness, Audrin spoke the answer, you will die on Oddstrith, the 19th day of any month.
In what month? In how many years? Cried Beresty.
But the bond was broken, and there was no answer. He ran into the circle and took the weaver Audrin by the throat, choking him, and shouted that if he got no further answer, he would break the weaver's neck. Others pulled him off and held him, though he was a strong man. He strained against their hands and cried out, give me the answer. Audrin said, it is given, and the price paid. Go. Raging then, Beresty, Rem Ir Ippi, returned to Cheruth, the third domain of his family, a poor place, in northern Osnarinner, which he had made poorer in getting together the price of a foretelling. He shut himself up in the strong place, in the highest rooms of the hearth tower, and would not come out for friend or foe, for seed time or harvest, for kemmer or foray, all that month, and the next, and 6 months went by, and 10 months went by, and he still kept like a prisoner to his room, waiting. On another had an Oddstrith, the 18th and 19th days of the month, he would not eat any food, nor would he drink, nor would he sleep. His kemmering, by love and vow, was Herber, of the Gaganer clan. This Herber came in the month of Grende to Thongaring Fastness, and said to the weaver, I seek a foretelling. What have you to pay? Audrin asked, for he saw that the man was poorly dressed and badly shod, and his sledge was old, and everything about him wanted mending. I will give my life, said Herber. Have you nothing else, my lord? Audrin asked him, speaking now as to a great nobleman. Nothing else to give?
I have nothing else, said Herber, but I do not know if my life is of any value to you here.
No, said Audrin, it is of no value to us. Then Herber fell on his knees, struck down by shame and love, and cried to Audrin, I beg you to answer my question. It is not for myself.
For whom, then? Asked the weaver.
For my lord and kemmering, Ashi Beresty, said the man, and he wept. He has no love, nor joy, nor lordship since he came here and got that answer, which was no answer. He will die of it.
That he will.
What does a man die of but his death? Said the weaver Audrin. But Herber's passion moved him, and at length he said, I will seek the answer of the question you ask, Herber, and I will ask no price. But bethink you, there is always a price. The asker pays what he has to pay. Then Herber set Audrin's hands against his own eyes in sign of gratitude, and so the foretelling went forward. The foretellers gathered and went into the darkness. Herber went among them and asked his question. And the question was, how long will Ashi Beresty Rem Ir Ippi live? For Herber thought thus to get the count of days or years, and so set his love's heart at rest with certain knowledge. Then the foretellers moved in the darkness, and at last Audrin cried in great pain as if he burned in a fire, longer than Herber of Gegener. It was not the answer Herber had hoped, but it was the answer he got. And having a patient heart, he went home to Cherith with it, through the snows of Grendi. He came into the domain and into the strong place and climbed the tower, and there found his Kemmering, Beresty, sitting as ever, blank and bleak, by an ash-smothered fire, his arms lying on a table of red stone, his head sunk between his shoulders. "Ashe," said Herbert, "I have been to Thangering Fastness, and have been answered by the foretellers. I asked them how long you would live, and their answer was, Beresty will live longer than Herbert." Beresty looked up at him, as slow as if the hinge in his neck had rusted, and said, "Did you ask them when I would die, then?" "I asked how long you would live."
"How long? You fool, you had a question of the foretellers and did not ask them when I am to die. What day, month, year? How many days are left to me? You asked how long? Oh, you fool, you staring fool. Longer than you, yes, longer than you."
Beresty took up the great table of red stone as if it had been a sheet of tin and brought it down on Herber's head. Herber fell, and the stone lay on him. Beresty stood a while, demented. Then he raised up the stone and saw that it had crushed Herber's skull. He set the stone back on its pedestal. He lay down beside the dead man and put his arms about him as if they were in Kemmer, and all was well. So the people of Cherith found them when they broke into the tower room at last. Beresty was mad thereafter, and had to be kept under lock, for he would always go looking for Herber, who he thought was somewhere about the domain. He lived a month thus, and then hanged himself on Oddstrith, the 19th day of the month of Thern. Chapter 5. The Domestication of Hunch. My landlady, a voluble man, arranged my journey into the east. If a person wants to visit fastnesses, he's got to cross the Cargav, over the mountains into Old Carhide, to Rur, the old king city. Now I'll tell you, a hearth fellow of mine runs a landboat caravan over the Esker Pass, and yesterday he was telling me over a cup of orsh that they're going to make their first trip this summer on Gethany Osmi. It having been such a warm spring, and the road already clear up to Engohar, and the ploughs will have the pass clear in another couple of days. Now you won't catch me crossing the Cargav. Erring rang for me and a roof over my head. But I'm a Moyeshta, praise to the 900 throne upholders, and blessed be the milk of Meshe, and one can be a Yomeshta anywhere. We're a lot of newcomers, see, for my lord Meshe was born 2,202 years ago, but the old way of the Handara goes back 10,000 years before that. You have to go back to the old land if you're after the old way. Now look here, Mr. I. I'll have a room in this island for you whenever you come back. But I believe you're a wise man to be going out of Erinrang for a while. For everybody knows that the traitor made a great show of befriending you at the palace. Now with old Tibby as the king's ear, things will go smooth again. Now if you go down to the new port, you will find my hearth fellow there, and if you tell him I sent you, and so on. He was, as I said, voluble, and having discovered that I had no Shifgrathor, took every chance to give me advice, even though he disguised it with ifs and as-ifs. He was the superintendent of my island. I thought of him as my landlady, for he had fat buttocks that wagged as he walked, and a soft, fat face, and a prying, spying, ignoble, kindly nature. He was good to me, and also showed my room while I was out to thrill-seekers for a small fee. See the mysterious envoy's room. He was so feminine in looks and manner that I once asked him how many children he had. He looked glum. He had never borne any. He had, however, sired 4. It was one of the little jolts I was always getting. Cultural shock was nothing much compared to the biological shock I suffered as a human male among human beings who were 5/6 of the time hermaphroditic neuters. The radio bulletins were full of the doings of the new prime minister, Pemer Harge Rem Irtibi. Much of the news concerned affairs up north in the Sinoth Valley. Tibby evidently was going to press Carhide's claim to that region. precisely the kind of action which on any other world at this stage of civilization would lead to war. But on Gethin, nothing led to war. Quarrels, murders, feuds, forays, vendettas, assassinations, tortures, and abominations, all these were in their repertory of human accomplishments, but they did not go to war. They lacked, it seemed, the capacity to mobilize. They behaved like animals in that respect, or like women. They did not behave like men or ants. At any rate, they never yet had done so. What I knew of Orgeron indicated that it had become, over the last 5 or 6 centuries, an increasingly mobilizable society, a real nation-state. The prestige competition, heretofore mostly economic, might force Karhide to emulate its larger neighbor, to become a nation instead of a family quarrel, as Estevan had said. To become, as Estevan had also said, patriotic. If this occurred, the Gethinians might have an excellent chance of achieving the conditions of war. I wanted to go to Orgeron and see if my guesses concerning it were sound, but I wanted to finish up with Karhide first. So I sold another ruby to the scar-faced jeweler in Eng Street, and with no baggage but my money, my ansible, a few instruments, and a change of clothes, set off as a passenger on a trade caravan on the first day of the first month of summer. The land boats left at daybreak from the wind-swept loading yards of the new port. They drove under the arch and turned east. 20 bulky, quiet-running, barge-like trucks on caterpillar treads, going single file down the deep streets of Erinrang through the shadows of the morning. They carried boxes of lenses, reels of sound tapes, spools of copper and platinum wire, bolts of plant fiber cloth raised and woven in the West Fall, chests of dried fish flakes from the Gulf, crates of ball bearings, and other small machine parts, and 10 truckloads of Orgata Cardic grain, all bound for the Pering storm border, the northeast corner of the land. All shipping on the great continent is by these electric-powered trucks, which go on barges on the rivers and canals, where possible. During the deep snow months, slow tractor plows, power sledges, and the erratic ice ships on frozen rivers are the only transport besides skis and man-hauled sledges. During the thaw, no form of transport is reliable, so most freight traffic goes with a rush come summer. The roads then are thick with caravans. Traffic is controlled, each vehicle or caravan being required to keep in constant radio touch with checkpoints along the way. It all moves along, however crowded, quite steadily at the rate of 25 miles per hour, Terran. Gethinians could make their vehicles go faster, but they do not. If asked why not, they answer, why? Like asking Terrans why all our vehicles must go so fast, we answer, why not? No disputing tastes. Terrans tend to feel they've got to get ahead, make progress. The people of winter, who always live in the year one, feel that progress is less important than presence. My tastes were Terran. And leaving Erinrang, I was impatient with the methodical pace of the caravan. I wanted to get out and run. I was glad to get clear of those long stone streets overhung with black steep roofs and innumerable towers, that sunless city where all my chances had turned to fear and betrayal. Climbing the Kargav foothills, the caravan halted, briefly but often, for meals at roadside inns. Along in the afternoon, we got our first full view of the range from a foothill summit. We saw Koster, which is 4 miles high from foot to crest. The huge slant of its western slope hid the peaks north of it, some of which go up to 30,000 feet. South from Koster, one peak after another stood out white against a colorless sky. I counted 13, the last an undefined glimmer in the mist of distance in the south. The driver named the 13 for me and told me stories of avalanches and land boats blown off the road by mountain winds, and snowplow crews marooned for weeks in inaccessible heights, and so on, in a friendly effort to terrify me. He described having seen the truck ahead of his skid and go over a 1,000-foot precipice. What was remarkable, he said, was the slowness with which it fell. It seemed to take all afternoon floating down into the abyss, and he had been very glad to see it at last vanish, with no sound at all, into a 40-foot snowdrift at the bottom. At third hour, we stopped for dinner at a large inn, a grand place, with vast roaring fireplaces and vast beam-roofed rooms full of tables loaded with good food. But we did not stay the night. Ours was a sleeper caravan, hurrying, in its Karhaidish fashion, to be the first of the season into the Pering storm country, to skim the cream of the market for its merchant entrepreneurs. The truck batteries were recharged, a new shift of drivers took over, and we went on. One truck of the caravan served as sleeper, for drivers only. No beds for passengers. I spent the night in the cold cab on the hard seat with one break along near midnight for supper at a little inn high in the hills. Karhide is no country for comfort. At dawn I was awake and saw that we had left everything behind except rock and ice and light and the narrow road always going up and up under our treads. I thought, shivering, that there are things that outweigh comfort, unless one is an old woman or a cat. No more inns now among these appalling slopes of snow and granite. At mealtimes, the land boats came silently to a halt one after the other on some 30-degree snow-encroached grade, and everybody climbed down from the cabs and gathered about the sleeper, from which bowls of hot soup were served, slabs of dried bread apple, and sour beer in mugs. We stood about, stamping in the snow, gobbling up food and drink, backs to the bitter wind that was filled with a glittering dust of dry snow. Then back into the land boats and on and up. At noon, in the passes of Weehawth at about 14,000 feet, it was 82 degrees Fahrenheit in the sun and 13 degrees in the shade. The electric engines were so quiet that one could hear avalanches grumble down immense blue slopes on the far side of chasms 20 miles across. Late that afternoon we passed the summit at Esker, 15,200 feet. Looking up the slope of the southern face of Koster, on which we had been infinitesimally crawling all day, I saw a queer rock formation, a quarter mile or so above the road, a castle-like outcropping. "See the fastness up there," says the driver. "That's a building. That's Arakoster fastness. But no one could live up here." "Oh, the old men can. I used to drive in a caravan that brought up their food from Irrenrang late in summer. Of course they can't get in or out for 10 or 11 months of the year, but they don't care. There's 7 or 8 indwellers up there." I stared up at the buttresses of rough rock, solitary in the huge solitude of the heights, and I did not believe the driver, but I suspended my disbelief. If any people could survive in such a frozen eyrie, they would be Karhiders. The road descending swung far north and far south, edging along precipices, for the east slope of the Kargav is harsher than the west, falling to the plains in great stair-steps, the raw fault-blocks of the mountains making. At sunset, we saw a tiny string of dots creeping through a huge white shadow 7,000 feet below, a land-boat caravan that had left Arrenrang a day ahead of us. Late the next day, we had got down there and were creeping along that same snow slope, very softly, not sneezing, lest we bring down the avalanche. From there we saw for a while, away below and beyond us eastward, vague vast lands blurred with clouds and shadows of clouds and streaked with silver of rivers, the plains of Rur. At dusk of the fourth day out from Arrenrang, we came to Rur. Between the two cities lie 1,100 miles and a wall several miles high and 2 or 3,000 years. The caravan halted outside the western gate, where it would be shifted onto canal barges. No land boat or car can enter Rur. It was built before Karhiders used powered vehicles, and they have been using them for over 20 centuries. There are no streets in Rur. There are covered walks, tunnel-like, which in summer one may walk through or on top of as one pleases. The houses and islands and hearths sit every which way, chaotic, in a profuse, prodigious confusion that suddenly culminates, as anarchy will do in Karhide, in splendor. The great towers of the Un-Palace, blood-red, windowless. Built 17 centuries ago, those towers housed the kings of Karhide for 1,000 years, until Argovan Hargi, first of his dynasty, crossed the Kargav and settled the great valley of the West Fall. All the buildings of Rur are fantastically massive, deep-founded, weatherproof, and waterproof. In winter, the wind of the plains may keep the city clear of snow, but when it blizzards and piles up, they do not clear the streets, having no streets to clear. They use the stone tunnels, or burrow temporary ones in the snow. Nothing of the houses but the roof sticks out above the snow, and the winter doors may be set under the eaves or in the roof itself, like dormers. The thaw is the bad time on that plain of many rivers. The tunnels then are storm sewers, and the spaces between buildings become canals or lakes, on which the people of Rur boat to their business, fending off small ice floes with the oars. And always, over the dust of summer, the snowy roof jumble of winter, or the floods of spring, the red towers loom, the empty heart of the city, indestructible. I lodged in a dreary, overpriced inn, crouching in the lee of the towers. I got up at dawn, after many bad dreams, and paid the extortioner for bed and breakfast, and inaccurate directions as to the way I should take, and set forth afoot to find Otherhord, an ancient fastness not far from Rur. I was lost within 50 yards of the inn. By keeping the towers behind me and the huge white loom of the Kargav on my right, I got out of the city, headed south, and a farmer's child met on the road, told me where to turn off for Otherhord. I came there at noon. That is, I came somewhere at noon, but I wasn't sure where. It was mainly a forest or a thick wood. But the woods were even more carefully tended than is usual in that country of careful foresters, and the path led along the hillside right in among the trees. After a while, I became aware that there was a wooden hut just off the path to my right, and then I noticed a quite large wooden building a little farther off to my left. And from somewhere there came a delicious smell of fresh, frying fish. I went slowly along the path, a little uneasy. I didn't know how the Hondurata felt about tourists. I knew very little about them, in fact. The Handara is a religion without institution, without priests, without hierarchy, without vows, without creed. I am still unable to say whether it has a god or not. It is elusive. It is always somewhere else. Its only fixed manifestation is in the fastnesses, retreats to which people may retire and spend the night or a lifetime. I wouldn't have been pursuing this curiously intangible cult into its secret places at all if I hadn't wanted to answer the question left unanswered by the investigators. What are the foretellers, and what do they actually do? I had been longer in Karhide now than the investigators had, and I doubted that there was anything to the stories of foretellers and their prophecies. Legends of prediction are common throughout the whole household of man. God speaks, spirits speak, computers speak. Oracular ambiguity or statistical probability provides loopholes, and discrepancies are expunged by faith. However, the legends were worth investigating. I hadn't yet convinced any Karhider of the existence of telepathic communication. They wouldn't believe it till they saw it. My position exactly regarding the foretellers of the Handara. As I went on along the path, I realized that a whole village or town was scattered about in the shadow of that slanting forest, all as random as Rur was, but secretive, peaceful, rural. Over every roof and path hung the boughs of the hemans, the commonest tree of winter, a stout conifer with thick, pale scarlet needles. Hemon cones littered the branching paths. The wind was scented with hemon pollen, and all the houses were built of the dark hemon wood. I stopped at last, wondering which door to knock at, when a person came sauntering out of the trees and greeted me courteously. "Will you be looking for a dwelling place?" he asked. "I've come with a question for the foretellers. I had decided to let them take me, at first anyhow, for a car hider. Like the investigators, I had never had any trouble passing as a native, if I wanted to. Among all the Karhidish dialects, my accent went unnoticed, and my sexual anomalies were hidden by the heavy clothing. I lacked the fine, thick hair thatch and the downward eye slant of the typical Gathenian, and was blacker and taller than most, but not beyond the range of normal variation. My beard had been permanently depilated before I left Alul. At that time, we didn't know yet about the pelted tribes of Perenter, who are not only bearded, but hairy all over, like white Terrans. Occasionally, I was asked how my nose got broken. I have a flat nose. Gathenian noses are prominent and narrow, with constricted passages, well adapted to breathing sub-freezing air. The person on the path at Othereth Horde looked with mild curiosity at my nose and answered, "Then perhaps you'll want to speak to the weaver. He's down in the glade now, unless he went out with the wood sledge. Or would you rather talk first to one of the celibates?" "I'm not sure. I'm exceedingly ignorant." The young man laughed and bowed. "I am honored," he said. "I've lived here 3 years, but haven't yet acquired enough ignorance to be worth mentioning." He was highly amused, but his manner was gentle, and I managed to recollect enough scraps of Handara lore to realize that I had been boasting, very much as if I'd come up to him and said, "I'm exceedingly handsome." I meant, I don't know anything about the foretellers. "Enviable," said the young indweller. "Behold, we must sully the plain snow with footprints in order to get anywhere. May I show you the way to the glade? My name is Goss." It was a first name. "Genry," I said, abandoning my L. I followed Goss farther into the chill shade of the forest. The narrow path changed direction often, winding up the slope and down again. Here and there, near it or away off among the massive trunks of the hemons, stood the small forest-colored houses. Everything was red and brown, dank, still, fragrant, gloomy. From one of the houses drifted the faint whistling sweetness of a Karhidish flute. Goss went light and quick, graceful as a girl, some yards ahead of me. All at once his white shirt blazed out, and I came out after him from shadow into full sunlight on a wide green meadow. 20 feet from us stood a figure, straight, motionless, profiled, the scarlet yeb and white shirt an inlay of bright enamel against the green of the high grass. 100 yards beyond him stood another statue in blue and white. This one never moved or glanced our way all the time we talked with the first one. They were practicing the Handara discipline of presence, which is a kind of trance. The Handarata, given to negatives, call it an untrance, involving self-loss. Self-augmentation? Through extreme sensual receptiveness and awareness. Though the technique is the exact opposite of most techniques of mysticism, it probably is a mystical discipline, tending towards the experience of immanence. But I can't categorize any practice of the Handarata with certainty. Goss spoke to the person in scarlet. As he broke from his intense movelessness and looked at us, and came slowly towards us, I felt an awe of him. In that noon sunlight, he shone of his own light. He was as tall as I, and slender, with a clear, open, and beautiful face. As his eyes met mine, I was suddenly moved to bespeak him, to try to reach him with the mind speech I had never used since I landed on Winter, and should not use yet. The impulse was stronger than the restraint. I bespoke him. There was no response. No contact was made.
He continued to look straight at me. After a moment, he smiled and said in a soft, rather high voice, "You're the envoy, aren't you?" I stammered and said, "Yes. My name is Fax. We're honored to receive you. Will you stay with us in Otherhord a while?" "Willingly. I am seeking to learn about your practice of foretelling, and if there's anything I can tell you in return about what I am, where I come from..." "Whatever you like," said Fax, with a serene smile. "This is a pleasant thing that you should cross the ocean of space, and then add another 1,000 miles and a crossing of the Karga to your journey to come to us here." "I wanted to come to Otherhord because of the fame of its predictions." "You want to watch us foretelling, then, perhaps? Or have you a question of your own?" His clear eyes compelled truth. "I don't know," I said. "Nasuth," he said, "it doesn't matter. Perhaps if you stay a while, you'll find if you have a question or no question. There are only certain times, you know, when the foretellers are able to meet together, so in any case you dwell with us some days." I did, and they were pleasant days. Time was unorganized except for the communal work, field labor, gardening, woodcutting, maintenance, for which transients such as myself were called on by whatever group most needed a hand. Aside from the work, a day might pass without a word spoken. Those I talked with most often were young Goss and Fax the Weaver, whose extraordinary character, as limpid and unfathomable as a well of very clear water, was a quintessence of the character of the place. In the evenings there might be a gathering in the hearthroom of one or another of the low, tree-surrounded houses. There was conversation and beer, and there might be music. The vigorous music of Karhide, melodically simple, but rhythmically complex, always played extempore. One night two indwellers danced, men so old that their hair had whitened and their limbs were skinny, and the downward folds at the outer eye corners half hid their dark eyes. Their dancing was slow, precise, controlled. It fascinated eye and mind. They began dancing during third hour after dinner. Musicians joined in and dropped out at will, all but the drummer, who never stopped his subtle, changing beat.